From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection this hour is made in a kind of paradox. The need for strong journalism is more acute than ever, and yet the number of paid journalism jobs is declining. Pew Research tracks this from multiple angles. The starting point is this. Fewer U.S. adults follow the news closely compared to 5 and 10 years ago. Americans are not as deeply engaged with the news. Of course, if you ask Americans whether they are well informed, they will overrate their own knowledge of facts and events. Some of that disconnect comes from the shrinking audiences for traditional news media, although as Pew points out, there are some exceptions. But newspaper subscriptions are down more than 70% since their peak in the late 1980s. What about digital? Well, Pew found that overall, digital traffic to newspapers' websites is declining. The average monthly number of unique visitors to the websites of the country's top 50 newspapers declined 20% in the fourth quarter of last year. And by the way, even the length of the average visit to those news sites is falling. You know how long people spend on an average news site? A minute and a half. Whew. Since the 1980s, average employment by newspaper publishers is down 63%. And since just 2008, the number of newsroom jobs in general is down 26%. So who wants to be a journalist? What student would choose journalism as a career? Well, here's a question. What if learning about journalism wasn't only about a career? What if there were skills that could be taken to a number of different careers? And what if those were skills where all of us could benefit? Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David K. Johnston is going back to college, I guess. He's teaching at RIT, and this fall his classes include Introduction to Journalism and Timely Topics, Law in Action. And with the maelstrom of the national news headlines from the past week alone, we thought it would be, yes, timely to bring David K. Johnston back to Connections. Nice to have you. Thank you for being here.
Glad to be here, Evan.
I was asking you just before the program began, you're teaching at RIT, a school that has a concentration in journalism, but not a major. Is that an issue to you?
No, not at all. And I'm apparently the first professor of practice, but I'll be teaching there full time. All the skills you would need to be a successful journalist are highly transferable to any business occupation that requires you to gather facts and effectively argue. I mean, for example, imagine you're an RIT STEM student. You leave and go into the technical fields. You do well, so you're promoted. And now you will need $50 million from the company to fund the project you think will best benefit the company. If you can't effectively write the reasons you should get the $50 million instead of the six or eight other managers who want that $50 million, you're not going to get it. So I expect that many of the journalism students are not planning careers in journalism, but I'll find out when classes start August 26th.
And teaching the law, what is your hope for teaching the law at RIT?
Well, the class that I've taught for the last 5 years at Syracuse, I used to teach before that the law of the ancient world as a way to teach the principles of modern law. You know, why do we have these tax laws and those property laws and these business regulatory laws? And they all come from the ancient world. But the class I've been teaching is to give people a thorough understanding of how the law works, what it is and what it isn't. You could simply call it a survey course on the law. I prefer to say it's a course in the theory and principle of law. And this course has proven to be especially valuable, not just to people who then go to law school, because it was an undergraduate course, but I've had people reach back to me who are in accounting, a government service, business, and I've literally had some of them say that 16, 17, 20 years of education, this was the single most valuable class they had. And in fact, that happened to me at a bookstore in Penfield this Sunday, where somebody I didn't recall came up to me and said, that was just the best course. I remember to this day, and it was so helpful to my career.
That's still meaningful to you to get feedback like that?
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah. And I think of the law course as, boy, everything I wish I had known when I was 20 years old, because I would be a very wealthy man today.
Well,
I hadn't made all the dumb mistakes I've made.
Isn't that all of us, though? When you have a class called Timely Topics, I don't know, is there anything timely? I don't feel like there's anything timely going on in the news or the law. I'm kidding.
Yeah.
There's quite a lot. But where do you start with these students? I mean, what is timely in your view that you want to include in teaching?
Well, I mean, the first thing I do is give them a very broad look at what is law. And law and lawyers are essentially the grease that makes civilization work.
That's a fascinating way.
But I also say, just remember, lawyers are the grease. law is civilization. And it is what sets up the rules and the guidelines on behavior so that we can live a reasonable amount of peace, address people who are not peaceful, accumulate assets, and protect those assets to help us disentangle from things like, say, terrible marriages. After I give them a broad overview of the law, including the fact that everything in modern American law can be found in Hammurabi's code from almost 4,000 years ago, with one exception: no intellectual property law, because there wasn't an intellectual property back then. But admiralty law, proto-bankruptcy law, audits, all of those sorts of things are there if you read them and analyze them. And the having an understanding of how human beings have gotten to where we are is crucial. And one of the key things I tell my students is law is always behind the culture, because law is based on human experience. So Leonardo da Vinci figured out how to build an airplane 500 years ago. He didn't have the materials to build one. So nobody thought up aviation law. But once we began to get airplanes people could pay to fly in to get somewhere, now we have to have aviation law. And what's coming in the future is we're in the digital age. Human beings mostly have lived in the hunter-gatherer and then agricultural age at the beginning of this country, and then the industrial age 150 years ago. The digital age that started about 50 years ago. And now we're on the cusp of the genetic or biological age, and it will require a whole new set of laws. But we have to have experience and things that go wrong before those laws get written, and they may be great laws and they may be not so great laws, depending on who writes them, how they're written, and how informed the public is.
This is already going in interesting directions I didn't anticipate, so let me just follow the thread of where my mind goes, and you can tell me what you think here. Talking to David K. Johnston, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, of course, who is now teaching at RIT, one of those classes, Timely Topics, in regards to the law in action. So when you talk about where societies go and kind of move through ages and how law has to sort of adapt, I don't know if the law or if anything can adapt quickly enough with the rate of change coming with AI and other things. So I appreciate the idea of going all the way back in time and understanding that there is a foundation in the law and that there's a reason that the laws have existed the way they have, that they're not largely not new, that these principles, these tenets go back literally thousands of years. But how do you deal with AI? How do you deal with intellectual property? How do you deal with safety? And all these related matters when it's changing so quickly?
Well, change always requires new laws, and it affects our economies. So electricity, as a practical matter, came along in the late 19th century. But it wasn't until 1955 that we'd electrified essentially all of America. Telephones came along in the 1870s, and I've actually picked up a telephone that was built in the 19th century, and it still works because it was on a copper landline of the kind that are, of course, rapidly disappearing. It'll answer calls from the new VoIP systems, but you can't make a call anymore. And so when law comes and it's disruptive, we have a disruptive period. But pretty quickly, the problems sort of begin to come to the attention of lawmakers. And of course, most of our business law is written by the businesses. The Interstate Commerce Act, that was our second significant business regulatory law in the United States, dealt with the railroads. The railroad companies were gouging the farmers in the South and the Midwest. They were picking up grains and other things at their convenience, not as promised in their schedules. So we got this regulatory body, the Interstate Commerce Commission, was its original name. But the rules were written by the railroads. The Pure Food and Drug Acts of 1906 that followed Upton Sinclair's novel, The Jungle, They were written by the food and drug industry. And in fact, we had a Pure Meat Act in 1890 to ensure customers knew the meat was safe to eat. It only applied to exports to Europe because the Europeans were saying, oh, American beef and chicken and pork, deadly. Do you eat that and you'll die? And so we got a law passed to protect Europeans, but not Americans. Law with AI will be adapted. It already is raising big questions about intellectual property. I'm an author. I have a real stake in that game. There are people out there who just have wholesale copied a couple of my books and they offer them to people. They're thieves, but we don't have an effective way to go after them. And the amount of money they're stealing from me doesn't make it a felony in all likelihood. And law enforcement is focused on yesterday's laws, just as generals and admirals tend to be focused on the last big war, not the one that's coming. So it will adapt well or not, depending on how informed and demanding the public is and the people who make use of this. And remember, business is not a monolith. There are businesses that create and then buy from others and do both. And so they have different and conflicting interests.
I want to ask you a little bit about copyright law. And then, listeners, I'm going to take a couple of phone calls. I've got already some emails for David K. Johnston, 844-295-TALK, if you want to weigh in, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. I want to set aside all the things that worry me about AI sort of existentially, whether it's how AI interacts with nuclear arsenals or general AI. And I just want to talk to you about some of what you just referenced as an author. So AI, if you ask it to write a 60,000-word book, it can do it pretty quickly right now. And the quality, I guess, is getting better. I've been sort of kind of a grump about it, and I've stayed away. But when I read poetry that AI writes, when I hear music that it created a Randy Travis song approximating his voice, I'm kind of disturbed. But on the copyright law, I want to ask you about this angle. Couldn't it be possible that, take music, a bunch of musicians come together and they say, look, AI is creating quote-unquote new music, but it is not new music. It is learning by consuming countless pieces of music that have been created by individuals who own that music. And it is fragmenting in its own way that is probably black boxed and we'll never know exactly how. But what it creates is not, for that reason, new. Just as if you ask it to write a nonfiction book, it would be taking maybe David K. Johnston's work, maybe other journalists, maybe other authors, and repackaging into something that's quote-unquote new, but it is not new, and therefore it is not in bounds for AI to do this, and it should be stopped. Is there a copyright claim there that could block this?
Well, that's a big fight we're about to see about this. But let me point out that, as the old preacher says in Ecclesiastes in the Old Testament, there is nothing new under the sun. The books that I've written, while they're full of original reportage, they're based on things that came from other places. There's a reason that people who write books or who teach, you know, sit in rooms full of books that they've read. That's how we acquire information. And AI uses this stuff called large language models.
Yeah.
They take it, just everything they can scoop up and put it into a memory. And sometimes, by the way, they write very funny things. A friend of mine said, write an essay about, he gave his own name, and it was hilarious. So I think that the copyright issue is, traditionally copyright has been the exact words of an article. So if I wrote an article back in the days when we did this, a big expose in the Detroit Free Press of a corrupt broadcaster who eventually was forced to shut down and go out of business, it says copyright Detroit Free Press 1973. So long as you don't quote the precise words, use my precise words, you can steal all the information and you're not violating the copyright. And so I think this may cause us to have a deeper thought about it. Now, the actress Scarlett Johansson, who is also a very smart businesswoman, she found that one of the companies was using a name that, boy, really sounded like her, artificially created, and she complained. Now, they backed off in her case, but what if it's Evan Dawson's voice? What if it's Mayor Malik Evans' voice? You know, you and the mayor don't have that kind of pull and attention to the issue. And there are a lot of laws in America that need a fundamental wholesale re-examination. And our laws dealing with intellectual property are right at the center of those things, especially as how they affect the profitability and success of business and the value of investing in research and development for future products and services. Because there's no point in investing in something if other people can just steal it from you. That's why we have supposed to be limited intellectual property rights in the Constitution, that authors and inventors are supposed to have exclusive right to their property for a limited period of time.
Talking to David K. Johnston about the law, about journalism, two subjects he is teaching at RIT. Starting when? When's the first class?
August 26th.
Next month. It's about a month
5 days
away.
A week. I'll be out there teaching.
About a month away. Let me grab our first phone call. This is Mark. Hello, Mark. Go ahead.
Hey, Evan. This is Mark Johns. How you doing?
Hey, Mark. Go ahead. Yep, good.
Look, I just wanted to say that there's a lot of things that go on that don't, you know, they're not Biden, they're not Trump. They're just the way the politicians do business behind the scenes. And it doesn't get reported because it's not a big scandal. But it's everyday politics. I mean, I'm not big on conspiracy theories, but why would Trump and his team be so stupid to have a debate with Biden before the conventions even take place? Why not say we'll do it right after Labor Day where it's too late to get rid of him? You know, I mean, these are games that are played behind the scenes that apparently no one even talks about. But it's out there. And some of the scandals, like I was down in Albany for a while, you never hear about them because it's not Washington.
Hmm. Well, Mark, thank you for that. David K. Johnston, we're going to set a modern record. It's been 18 minutes before we brought up Trump with you. So there, Mark has brought up Trump. So go ahead.
Well, first of all, Joe Biden proposed the debate, and it turned out to be a disaster for him. The most kindest thing you can say is his staff didn't tell him, take a nap before you go debate. Secondly, in fact, a great deal of what goes on in government that is not scandal-related was covered. I spoke one day with then-Senator Chris Dodd of Connecticut, and he said to me a young woman had walked up to him on the street in Washington, D.C. with a camera crew and shoved a microphone in his face from one of the Connecticut TV stations and said, give me a quote. And he said, about what? She said, anything. I've got to get a story today. And he then stepped back a moment and said, you know, when I came here as a member of Congress, there were 26 reporters from Connecticut covering my office. There was a guy at the Hartford Courant who knew the rules on helicopter contracting because Sikorsky Helicopters or Bell, whichever one, is a big business in Connecticut. And he knew the contracting rules and the efforts to play with them by competitors as well as any contracting officer at the Pentagon. And he said, it's all gone. It's all gone. Why is it gone? Because the public wasn't interested. And, Mark, there's been a great deal written about what you brought up about the debate. You know, you can subscribe to the New York Times for $50 a year online, the Washington Post for $120, and you will see an enormous amount of very lengthy, detailed reportage about all sorts of issues.
Do you... well, let me extend then on Mark's point, though. He says in Albany, it's not Washington, so things don't get covered. So
state capitals have been undercovered. And, you know, unlike every other occupation in journalism, we have journalism reviews. We're down to one now, the Columbia Journalism Review, who I was a columnist for 1 year. But I've written for other journalism reviews as well. And critically assessing the work of our peers is a fundamental part of the job. That's been diminished as there's been fewer and fewer journalists. I mean, the fastest disappearing white-collar job in America in this century is journalist. And that's not good for the public. You know who it's really good for, though? Local politicians who are inclined to steer contracts to their friends and do other things indicative of a kleptocracy. When is the last time in our local paper, which has lost 90% of its newsroom staff, covered a city council meeting? I can't remember, I live in Brighton, a Brighton school board or town council meeting being covered since the weekly paper, The Post, sort of went away and became just an advertising sheet. In fact, I don't even remember getting it in the last year or so. If you don't have reporters there, then you don't have the story. And even average, just grade level reporters, just like average, typical beat cops, the mere presence of reporters inhibits bad behavior. I've had many politicians tell me that over my career. But when there's no reporters, who knows?
Well, and so if you've got students, I take your point that RIT, it doesn't have a journalism major, it has a concentration, and that what you're going to teach in journalism classes could be applicable to all kinds of things.
Right.
But if you have students come to you and say, you know what, though, I think I want to be a journalist, what are you going to tell them?
Don't be a commodity. If you're just somebody who spins out stories and can do 15 stories a day by looking up what other people are writing, you can be replaced in a minute. And almost everybody and every job they have is a commodity. You know, a secretary is a secretary. A beat cop is a beat cop. A great prosecutor is a great prosecutor. There's plenty of them around. You want to develop things that make you valuable, that make you stand out. So if one of the things I've often pushed on journalists is that there are two enormously lucrative and yet important journalism prospects in the world. You have to use the Martha Stewart model of being polished beyond belief and thoughtful about your audience. But one is water. We're going to have wars fought over water in the next 100 years. We're going to have a huge fight to save and make sure that Great Lakes water isn't drained away to Kansas to grow wheat. And the other is animals. There's a place in the world for maybe three go-to animal journalists, both pets and wildlife. But if you want to do the water example on the Martha Stewart model, you have to learn patents, which is the property title to submerged land. Chemistry, physics for how water flows, atmospheric conditions, just a whole bunch of science that you've got to learn in the same way that, you know, when Martha Stewart tells you here's how to do a decoupage egg, she's practiced it and her staff has done it till they've got it solid.
But the law as well. A whole lot of science,
yep.
But the law as well. Okay, and so when David says, you know, don't be a commodity, I like the track then that you took because I see a fork in the road there that I think has a very deleterious effect on American life, on journalism, et cetera. And that's this. Because the way I would put it to students, the way I sometimes do, is be indispensable.
Yes.
Okay, be indispensable. Yeah. If most of us have bosses, if you've got a boss, you want that boss thinking, we cannot lose this person. How do you become that person? Well, in journalism, I think there's two ways, or at least in media, there's two ways. The way that you just described is the way that I would like the future of journalism to go. Specialized reporting, expertise, people who know more than the people in charge and are willing to bring it to the public. Then there is, well, I can differentiate myself by being loud, by being obnoxious, by doing the commercial talk radio thing, you know, by being controversial, by lying.
And sometimes by being humorous. In television, by just simply being gorgeous, male or female, yes, there are less than...
It's not a problem for you and me.
The best attribute... No. I was asked once why I didn't join CNN when it started, because I talked to him and I said, well, I have a face made for print.
But I'm worried that a lot of students are, to the extent that anybody wants to get into media or journalism, are seeing... You know, and granted, cable news is sort of going the way of newspapers, maybe not as fast, but I think that will happen.
Oh, yes, it's declining.
Okay. But podcasts are rising, and there's all kinds of vitriol gets attention. So I don't know that it's a healthy sort of ecosystem right now.
Well, I tell students, and I just came back from lecturing at the annual Investigative Reporters and Editors Conference, where we train people in investigative reporting, and I'm a former president of IRE. And lots of young people come to me because of my reputation at these things. And I listen to the circumstances they're in, and I'll say to some of them, is this really what you want to do? I mean, you could take the same skills and go become a detective. You don't have to wear a uniform. You could become a detective for the district attorney's office. You could be a private detective or corporate detective. You know, you want to think through if it's worth it. I had one little group talking to me in Anaheim, and one of them said, well, how much did you make in your first job? And I said, you're not going to like this. I was 19 years old. I got hired at the San Jose Mercury, which is now the sixth largest newspaper in America. And in today's money, my base pay was $65,000. None of these young journalists who graduated from college and were all in their mid to late 20s, none of them was making $40,000. And so you're not going to get the talent. It's the same problem we have with schools. Why do we have lots of teachers in public schools who aren't so good? Because we don't pay enough for the brains we need. Mm-hmm. We still think we're being subsidized by a system where single women, before they got married, or maybe some of them after they got married, were teaching school and they would accept relatively low pay. That's gone. The system's changed, and we haven't caught up with it, and we seriously underpay teachers, and we get what we pay for.
We're talking to David K. Johnston, and let's go ahead and take Frank's call. Frank's been waiting. Hello, Frank. Go ahead.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. We're talking about journalism. We're talking about technology. We're talking about being human. One of my favorite games in the tavern is to walk up to the first engineer I can find, preferably a managing engineer, and say, of all the people you've fired in the last 2 years, what percentage of the people you fired were for human resource reasons, not technology reasons? Their technology was fine. Their personal skills stink. And they tell me between 30 and 50%. So if that's relevant, I'd like to hear some comments. Thank you.
David?
Well, learning how to get along with other people is very crucial to be success in any area. At the LA Times, where we paid interns in the summer really well, they made a shift while I was there from whatever state college you went to bringing in interns from Ivy League schools. And a young man from Harvard was, and I was often assigned to train interns and have lots of joint bylines with them. And a young man from Harvard was assigned to sit next to me. An editor gave him his first assignment. It was to write one paragraph for page two of the paper. And I explained to him what was expected of him. And he wrote 3,000 words. And I told him, if you turn that in, it will show that you can't follow a simple directive. They will pay you all summer. You will never get your byline in the newspaper, which is exactly what happened. I wish I could find him because I'd like to hear his version of this story. But you know, you start out doing little things, and if you do them well, you get bigger and bigger things. And you have to get along with people. And newsrooms, especially if you do investigative reporting, are very contentious, but they also have a different culture than most businesses. I literally watched a news clerk dress down the executive editor of the New York Times in front of about 40 of us. And he knew he had to take it because that's the culture of the newsroom. She had a legitimate beef, and he had to stand there and he had to take it. You can walk into the top editor, the number two editor, even if you're a news clerk, and talk to them. So this is not the kind of hierarchical report-filling experience most people have in corporate America, or for that matter, very large nonprofits like universities.
Frank, thanks for the phone call. Tom wants to know a couple of things. His first question, can you ask David if he sees a journalism model that actually works in the age of disappearing print media?
Well, I don't think the platform matters, whether it's a newspaper or it's online or if it's audio, it's a slower way to impart information. So I don't listen to podcasts because I can read faster and pick up stuff faster. The financial model is quite clear. We need to have charitable endowment money to fund things. For example, NPR has a roughly $200 million endowment left by Joan Kroc, the widow of the founder of, or the guy who built up McDonald's. And from that, they can draw $10 million or so a year. But you have to separate the endowment from the news organization, because if it isn't separate and creating a legal wall, people who don't like your reporting will go and destroy the endowment. And getting people to donate to endowments is difficult. Most people don't like to do it. It was the business my wife was in, and we sacrificed for 25 years to fund a small endowment in our names and a couple of scholarships. But I don't see any commercial model. I do see one thing that the local paper is doing that's very smart. On Sundays now, they have this section called Legacies, and it's paid death notices. They're not obituaries. They're paid death. There's one obituary on the cover, and then it's paid death notices. Those are highly profitable. People look them up to see, did any of my friends or former associates die? And the Los Angeles Times, which has shrunk from 1.1 million papers a day when I worked there to under 100,000, they would be doing much better. They would have more ads if they did this. There are actually more lines of advertising, because I put the paper down a couple days and measured, in the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle than there are in the Los Angeles Times, which says there's something seriously wrong with the business model. You know, newspapers have always been a market that brings together buyers and sellers. And journalists are essentially the barker outside the tent at a low-rent place. It's come in and see the amazing two-headed mermaid. And at more serious places, it's come in and we'll have a discussion about, you know, why your taxes are the way they are or how effectively the government is running the water system. But journalists, that's their job. This is a marketplace. There are people who bought newspapers for centuries just for the ads. They didn't care about the news. They just wanted the ads.
Give to endowments. That's a good thing. I'm not going to do a big WXXI pitch right now. We're not in a pledge campaign, but you can do that any day of the year, listeners. And Tom also wants to know, what is David's take on corporate conglomerates like Sinclair owning local TV stations and even dictating mandatory content?
You know, I'm a big champion of competitive market capitalism. All the brilliant things Adam Smith figured out in his 1776 book, The Wealth of Nations, are connected to competitive market capitalism, not monopolies or oligopolies. We used to have a rule. You could own 7 TV stations, 7 FM stations, 7 AM stations. You could own them all in one place if you wanted. You have a triple, but only 7. And Congress undid those rules. And so Sinclair and Clear Channel and a few others now have these enormous collections of stations. And it's very bad. It's not competitive. It doesn't lead to new and better ideas. It allows, if you're smart about it, in an oligopoly, if you have 3 companies control a market, they can actually raise prices higher and faster than a monopoly if they do it right. That's explained in my book, Free Lunch, how that happens. But what we need in America desperately is competition. We need more competition. We have this terrible tendency. It's a natural tendency of capitalism, which has done a lot of good things in the world. But it's a natural tendency of capitalism to go toward monopoly because the weaker, more poorly financed or mismanaged enterprises eventually become vulnerable and they fold and they get bought by big ones. And that's why you need to have a system to, you know, separate those to limit growth. And politicians are, no voters care, so they're, you know, doing the bidding of the people who want to profit from having monopolies and oligopolies. There are whole industries in this country that exist only because legislation authorizes and allows them. They're totally superfluous and useless, and I've written about those in my
books. What's an example?
Land title insurance. 95% or more of the money you pay for land title insurance, which typically now is about 1% of the purchase price of a property, certainly never less than 0.5%, that doesn't go to do anything for you. Because these companies have to report their data, and I've analyzed it. And most of it goes to commercial, lawful, but commercial bribes. The different title companies, and then the phone book, they'll look, well, when we had phone books, it looks like there were a lot of title companies. There's basically 5 title companies. They just use lots of names. The same thing is in the funeral home industry. And they buy baseball tickets for people. They hold lunches and pay for the realtors to have lunch or the real estate lawyers to have lunch and things like that, rather than what's needed. And we could replace it very simply. Since most houses are bought with a mortgage, the real people at risk in a transaction, if there's a mortgage, aren't the buyers, it's the bank. And if banks did this wholesale, they probably offer you title insurance for $25, and some of them might say, we'll just include it in the price, not $1,000 or $2,000.
A brief note before I go back to the phones. For listeners who are hearing David K. Johnston talk about capitalism, and talk about the need to essentially go to a Brandeis, you know, kind of ethos, the trust busting, the anti-monopoly, the protection against concentration of economic power. And they'd be tempted to say, well, you're just a regulatory lefty. But what you often point out is we don't actually have pure competition. We shouldn't act like we do, because there is enormous power already in the bigger actors, and they are given more power through their friends in government.
And the benefits of capitalism come from competition. That's very clear. Anybody who studied economics learns that. They're very clear. Monopolies, duopolies, and oligopolies, they are damaging. They create what are called deadweight losses. Society is worse off, but a handful of people are richer.
Questions from listeners. One wants to know, does David watch local TV news? What news sources does David trust in news?
I subscribe to, at the moment, I think about 10 or 12 newspapers. The New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the LA Times, the Guardian, the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle. I just recently dropped the Detroit Free Press, where I worked 50 years ago. The San Jose Mercury, where I worked almost 60 years ago. I take a whole slew of current events magazines, the New Republic, which has been revived and is terrific, the New Yorker, et cetera. And I go to a lot of different websites. And then one of my grown children does research for me. And so when I say, gee, I need to know about this, she's an extraordinarily talented researcher. And she just very quickly comes up with different news accounts of what it is that I need. And, of course, I read DC Report, which I'm no longer the publisher of, but I contribute to it, dcreport.org.
I hope that helps. David K. Johnston is my guest here. And David is a regular visitor here. Usually we try to respect his time, but we know listeners appreciate hearing from David. And he is teaching at RIT starting next month. His classes will include Introduction to Journalism and Timely Topics, Law in Action. He's been talking about not only how he's going to approach those subjects with his students, but some of the modern events happening right now that students may be asking about, or that he might incorporate into some of the work that he's going to do with students. He said 5 days a week. Is that right?
Yeah. Well,
it's a big schedule.
I'm a full-time professor starting next month.
It's a big schedule.
Yeah. Yeah. There aren't many of us at 75 years old who get to go get a full-time job.
I was going to say, no slowing down.
I really enjoy this. At Syracuse, where I taught one day a week, I just really looked forward to every Monday and teaching. On the other side of that, my wife, she stays teaching. She does one-offs as a favor at various colleges here in town. But I said, why don't you teach? She goes, no, I don't want to.
Well, different strokes, David.
And, yep.
Different David writes to say, I couldn't agree more about the need for expert journalists. Even from personal experience, more than once, reporters have grossly misrepresented what I said when interviewed by them, especially in my old role as an academic scientist. I think mostly because they did not understand what I said, because they did not understand the basics of the subject they were interviewing me about. That occurred even in an interview with the BBC.
Listen, I thoroughly understand that. I have had hundreds and hundreds of articles written about my work over the last 58 years, and many of them were just awful. I mean, the words quoted were what I said, but the writer didn't know what they were doing. And the two best articles appeared in a small daily in North Carolina and in the old Brighton-Pittsford Post, of all places. So it isn't the size or quality of the news organization. It was the skill and underlying knowledge of the particular journalist.
Dallas says, but what is journalism? Is it getting a degree, going to the right parties, making the right friends, and then working from home, following up on leads online, calling the right friends? Is it sitting home waiting for scoops to call you? Or is it like a black and white movie with a guy smoking a cigarette and doing whatever it takes to get into a warehouse like a gumshoe? Journalism, to me these days, seems like every other work from home job. I think a lot of people feel that way too. Otherwise, they would read the news more.
Well, journalism, first of all, there are no rules in journalism. Except for one thing, you sign your work for all the world to read. So there's a newsroom saying, I doubt I made it up, though I once paid money to have somebody research it, and the first published version of this had my name on it. Doctors bury their mistakes. Lawyers send theirs off to prison. Only journalists sign theirs on the front page for everyone to read. there are all different kinds of journalism. I mean, there's sports journalism where you cover the team, and there's sports journalism where you cover the culture and ethics of sports. There are reporters who, like me, spend a lot of time reading documents that used to be in, you know, windowless basements looking for something to prove some corruption. There's a whole range of things that happen here, and you need to have that. Newspapers, for example, need to have a couple of people on the staff who can write funny. People always want and need funny, but you also need someone who, you know, certainly in a big city anyway, who can cover society, because that's sort of a messaging system among the elite. You need somebody who understands education and other things. So journalism is whatever we choose to make it. The important thing is that journalists understand that accuracy does not equal truth, and by that I mean small t truth, not capital T received truth, but as best we can figure things out in context. And lots of journalists think that, well, if I'm accurate, that's all I need to do. And that's a real serious problem for the public.
Let me just add an idea here, because I think there was a little bit of acid dripping from Dallas's email, you know, implying that, is it just, and like these other stay-at-home online jobs where you're waiting for someone to call you? No, Dallas, that is not really what journalism is. And in fact, I think a big problem with the decline in the size of newsrooms is great journalism often requires a lot of time. And when there is pressure to produce something for whatever platform you're on every day or multiple times a day, it is hard to find the time to do the kind of work that David is talking about.
Oh, and money. I mean, there were years when I was at the LA Times where my expense account was larger than my salary. Once when I was doing a feature, it was an investigative feature. It was a feature about corruption in the thrift store business and how, unbeknownst to anybody, these two families sort of were making millions and millions of dollars off what seemed to be a charity. An editor called me in and he said, I want this fact we talked about. And I said, well, that's going to take 2 weeks of my time and $10,000 of expense money. And he goes, yeah. Now, today, to get to what would be maybe $30,000 or $40,000 today. They thought nothing of it. And I went and did it for one paragraph, really one sentence. There isn't that kind of money around these days, with the exception of Bloomberg and the New York Times. Everybody else has shrunk. Those are the two standout exceptions.
All right, Hal, next in Livingston County. Hello, Hal. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'm a big fan of both of you. I was wondering if you could explain why, when I visit my daughter in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and look around for even the Sunday New York Times in any kind of drugstore or what used to be called a newsstand, you can't find it. Whereas in rural Livingston County, I can have the Sunday Times delivered to my mailbox and have unlimited digital access for $24 a month. How does that work? Yeah. It just doesn't make sense.
This is the absolute insanity of the collapse of something. When I was a little boy, I lived on an orange ranch in Orange, California. Once a lot of farmers started selling out to build housing, the infrastructure went away. And so everybody had to sell out, because if you could grow oranges, there was no way to get them processed and sent to market. Well, the same thing's happening with newspapers. So I get home delivery of the New York Times in Brighton, the physical paper, when it comes, which isn't always. But the circulation of the paper, which was over a million when I was there, is now down to, I think, around 320,000. And they're trying, everybody's in newspapers trying to basically kill the print product with some exceptions. And what I predicted 1994 would happen, and I said 40 years, so we're not quite there yet, 30 to 40 years, was that you would get by the post office the soft sections that are not on deadline. The Sunday magazine, book review, cooking, home, garden, stuff like that. And it would probably come on Thursday, not Sunday, because if you're a movie theater owner, a nightclub owner, you don't want people to know on Sunday. You want them to know on Thursday to plan their weekend. And I think we're seeing it going that direction. I'll be surprised if the DNC is in print 7 days a week 2 years from now.
All right. Briefly on your students, I mean, I guess you're going to learn a lot about your students a month from now when you start teaching 5 days a week at RIT. But you talk to students all the time, and you've taught for a long time. What do you think students, what do you think their overall perception of journalism is now?
Absolutely minimal. I mean, one of the things I learned in my Syracuse classes is students don't read newspapers. They don't go to movies. They don't watch TV. I asked students maybe 2 or 3 years ago, how many of you have seen a Star Wars movie? Very few hands went up. How many of you seen a Star Trek movie? Very few hands went up. They play video games. That's the thing. They have group dates and they play video games. And they don't date either in the traditional sense of this is my boyfriend or this is my girlfriend. Doesn't mean they're not doing what people in their 20s are known to do a lot of, but it's not the same on a building or looking to build a romantic relationship. And I think these are very troubling changes, and society will adapt to them as it does to everything else. But many students, they don't read novels. In fact, one of the most troubling things I've learned is the number of students, including some from what I think would be considered good high school districts, who instead of being assigned to read a novel, were shown the movie. If you watch Gregory Peck as Atticus Finch, he's ready-made for you. If you read the novel To Kill a Mockingbird, you have to create your own Atticus Finch, and yours, Evan, is not mine. And that's how we learn about what sociologists call capital T, capital O, the other. It's really important that we teach narrative. And we got to get young people paying attention to news if we're going to sustain our democracy and have a government that represents the people.
Briefly, we mentioned a little bit of, you know, how you might incorporate modern topics, timely topics. That's the name of the class, Timely Topics on the Law. If a student asks you, hey, let's talk about this immunity case, is that going to be part of class? The Trump immunity case, the Supreme Court case.
Yeah, in the law class, we'll absolutely talk about this very strange immunity decision that's completely out of character with any notion of originalism, textualism, or conservatism, and what that means. But I spend very little of the class on those sorts of things. I'm trying to get across fundamental legal principles. Why do you have the right to subpoena a witness? Why do you have the right to get exculpatory evidence if you're accused of a crime? What are the rules on property ownership? I mean, the very first substantive lecture I'll give after the broad introduction is about a woman from Rochester, New York, 120 plus years ago, who found her photograph, without her face directly, an angled shot, on boxes of flour for sale, and it had been appropriated. And the chief judge in New York State, when the case finally got before him, said, this young woman should be proud and thrilled that they're using her image, and there's no violation of her privacy. Then he got nominated to be president of the United States as a Democrat in the 1904 election, and suddenly photographers are in his face all the time. He's saying, what are you doing shooting my picture? You don't have my permission? So sometimes judges, you know, are completely at odds with the cases they've decided.
And then before the time is up here, I did want to ask you a little bit about how there is how the coverage of the Trump campaign has been, because you're someone who's covered Donald Trump perhaps more than any American journalist. And so my question is this. After the debate, we heard a number of listeners emailing me, David, saying, well, listen, why do you keep talking about Biden? It's Trump who is unfit. Maybe Biden's unfit, but Trump's unfit. You have to say that Trump's unfit. Talk about Trump's age. Talk about Trump's stumbles. And so let me also just get your take here, Professor Johnson.
Well, I think that the coverage of the campaign has been very, very troubling. There's a group of former New York Times people, a couple thousand of us, and we've been hotly debating how the Times has been sort of campaigning to get Joe Biden out of there and how it seems to be driven in part by the fact that Biden holds the press corps in contempt, more so than maybe any other president but Donald Trump. And so he doesn't talk to reporters. And, you know, Nancy Pelosi's daughter did a documentary about the 2000 election, and the most revealing scene is George Bush walks back in the campaign plane and says, well, hi, how you doing? Hey, David, that third grandson of yours, did he finish college yet? What do you call him, a shorty? And he was just charming. And then Al Gore walks back in another scene and goes, all right, my staff says I have to talk to you people. I'll take two questions. And guess what? Gore got lousy coverage because of that. I mean, it shouldn't be that way, but, you know, reporters are human beings just like everybody else. Contempt to cop shouldn't be a crime on the streets, but, you know, be contemptuous of a cop and you'll discover there's an unwritten law.
But my response, and we're down to our last 45 seconds, my response was, Donald, the reason that Biden was struggling in the polls is not because no one was talking about Donald Trump's unfitness. That's been covered for years.
I agree.
Voters, the cake is baked with most voters on that. Not all. There are tens of thousands of swing staters still undecided in about seven states. But I don't think it's because journalists weren't talking about Donald Trump.
No. If you read the major news organizations, there's tons of coverage. Now, I just turned in a piece to DC Report about Kamala Harris and how this changes the whole ballgame and why. It may be up by now if it isn't. DCReportSingular.org. It'll be up later today. But this has completely changed the ballgame. So you had a man with great economic record, despite what Donald says, but no charisma. Now you have a charismatic, powerful prosecutor who knows how to make a case. It's a whole new ballgame.
You know, the funny thing is Donald Trump actually does say that the economy is doing great. He says it's doing great because Wall Street thinks he's going to win.
Yeah.
I love
that. When he isn't saying we're in a recession and if I don't get back to office, it's the end of the country.
Yeah. I mean,
just scary.
That rhetoric is still there. Take a look at who introduced J.D. Vance in Ohio yesterday and what was said. Scary stuff. David K. Johnston is not just a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He's Professor David K. Johnston at RIT now and a professor of practice there who starts teaching in a month on journalism and the law. Have fun with the students. Come back and talk to us soon, I hope.
Hope so.
Thank you very much. More Connections coming up in just a moment.